We were there at the dawn of the third age of mankind, in the Earth year 2257, deep in neutral space. We were there when the last of the Babylon stations was founded. The name of the pod is Babylon 5.
Episode 9, and the Sky Full of Stars, in which Commander Sinclair is abducted by anti-alien enhanced interrogation technique enthusiasts who prove to be staggeringly incompetent at their job. But despite their efforts, the commander begins to recall some surprising details about what happened to him at the final battle of the Earth-Minbari War.
Where am I?
In the village.
What do you want?
Information.
Whose side are you on?
That would be telling. We want information. Information. Information!
You won't get it.
By hook or by crook, we will.
Who are you?
The new number two.
Who is number one?
You are number six.
I am not a number, I am a free man.
Welcome, friends, to the Name of the Pod, your Babylon 5 podcast, where we're looking at the ongoing cultural legacy of Babylon 5. I am your co-host, John Cassie, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host and your good friend,
Chris Tatro. How's it going, John?
Hi, Chris. All good?
Doing great.
You know, any episode that's going to let us start off by recreating the iconic opening to The Prisoner, the 1960s British spy, psychedelic, mind-blowing, amazing piece of television is an episode worth taking. So,
and this is a even on its own merits, this is a solid Babylon 5 episode that's going to contribute right. In a huge way to the canon, to the bigger picture. Should probably say we're, of course, talking about In the Sky Full of Stars.
Right.
And there's a lot of meat in this one.
But, yes.
You know, as we are both, as John said, huge fans of The Prisoner, we want to start off talking about that. It's pretty clear through this episode and also through other things throughout that J. Michael Straczynski was also a huge fan of the series. I mean, we get Bester as he leaves the station right. Back in Mind War, giving the "be seeing you,"
right? The classic greeting, or departure greeting in the village.
Yeah.
So I mean, J. Michael Straczynski clearly has a soft spot in his heart for The Prisoner, and so do we. And this episode and The Sky Full of Stars is full of reference points and a tone that's trying to capture the last couple of episodes of The Prisoner, which, folks listening, if you have not watched The Prisoner,
stop the podcast right now
and go watch it.
Watch it. Right. It's only 17, 18 episodes.
You know, 17 episodes. Yeah. And the last two in which our hero, number six, is trying to get the answers that he's been looking for in the whole episode. He's subjected to something called degree absolute between. It's essentially a kind of a mind war between himself and number two, and only one of them can endure, and only one of them can will break. And
that's very much what we see here.
Right. It's very much what we see here. It's the same idea.
Yeah. Yeah, in some ways, I think that this episode would have been stronger if they had leaned more on the prisoner, leaned more in the concept of how to break someone's mind,
right.
Unpacked it more from what we'd seen in The Prisoner with various different attempts and feints and subterfuges, rather than
right.
trying to brute force Sinclair's mind. Because what we get are these knights, Knight 1 and Knight 2,
right.
We only get their names in the credits. I don't think they're ever spoken. But
right.
The interrogator is just really trying to brute force his way in through Sinclair's mind, which just is not going to work. I mean, I could tell you that, and I have no memory of this show. So why it did make me wonder why right away he tells Sinclair you're in a simulation, whereas in The Prisoner it's never clear exactly what's going on. Is he in some kind? And in some episodes, yes, he's in a drug induced hallucination.
Right.
But maybe all of them are. Maybe he is still inside the whole thing the whole time. You can never really be sure exactly what's happening in that show, and it keeps number six off balance. I think it would have been better to keep Sinclair a little more off balance rather than just demanding over and over again, tell us what happened. Tell us what happened. Well, I don't know. I don't remember.
Right. I mean, one of our critiques of Babylon 5, as it's trying to make its way through these first 10 or 12 episodes, is given a choice between brute forcing the story or trying to go a little bit more subtle, they're always choosing the brute force. It's back to the journalist looking for that interview. She's trying to brute force her way through when in fact, as a features reporter, she should have been able to get in there through a different pathway, right? This night too is subjected to the same kind of direction that half a dozen other characters that we've spoken about are subjected to, which is you're not chewing on the scenery enough, chew on it even more. I mean, he's got this kind of a sort of cartoon villain kind of vibe to him. And he really shouldn't have that. Ideally, I mean, at least as far as I'm concerned, because without trying to brute force it, if he were trying to be a little bit more attenuated, then that's going to turn up the menace and also turn up the, wait a minute, what exactly is going on here? Right. And that would have made the fact that we as viewers actually know nothing. Right. All we know is there's a hole in his mind. And that hole happened at the Battle of the Line that ended with an inexplicable surrender by the combatant that had all but won. I mean, we come at it from the same perspective, as Jakar, I think, in Gathering, where he was like, you had them on their knees and you stopped. Why would you do this? Right. And since so much of what we're doing here is mystery, give us more of that mystery, right?
Right.
Now, Chris, you and I have talked about the fact that we know that J. Michael Straczynski wanted to get Patrick McGoohan, the star of The Prisoner,
yes,
for that night two role, for the role of the interrogator.
Yeah.
And my word, talk about an Elseworlds. Can you imagine this episode if Patrick McGoohan had been essentially in the role of number two?
Yeah. In some ways, I feel like Christopher Neame. Maybe he was almost trying to channel McGoohan in his delivery in this. But to have the real deal there, I mean, Patrick McGoohan had been kicking about through the 70s, and the 80s on Columbo, every fourth week or something
right,
like that.
Right.
But apparently he was going to be out of the country and wasn't going to be available. Man, that really would have been a dream.
It would have been shocking.
To see him turning the tables, reversing the role. He's now in the position of number two, as opposed to the one he's the interrogator now. Seeing him play it from that side of the table my nerdy little heart would have grown three sizes that day.
Right. It's total fan service, right?
Absolutely.
But I would have been delighted to receive it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Now here's something, and I haven't read this anywhere, and you and I haven't talked about this, but when this episode was made, Leo McKern was still alive. Now, Leo McKern, to those of you who are naive to The Prisoner, Leo McKern was number two early in the series. Number two is sort of the main adversary to number six. And Leo McKern came back at the end as the number two who was trying to break the prisoner, was trying to break number six. I might have tried to get Leo McKern again for fan service.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know if he was still acting or if he'd retired or whatever. I mean, Leo McKern died in 2002, but
Maybe his rates were too high or something. I don't know.
Yeah, but maybe.
And it's interesting that at the end of The Prisoner, in The Degree Absolute, there's another. That's the brute forcing that we see here. After everything else has failed, after they've exhausted all of these other attempts, Chimes of Big Ben, I think, is my favorite of the series, which is really, that's the sort of thing we're talking about that I would have liked to have seen Sinclair go through here, where you just don't know what's going on. In that episode, the prisoner believes he's escaped from the island that the village is on and is back in London, and he's getting debriefed by his superiors there. What happened? What where were you? And they ask the same question that number two has been trying to get out of him all along. Why did you resign?
Right.
And at that point he catches on. He almost says, but he catches on and stops. It's trickery as opposed to the brute force. But that is the closest that I think they ever got to catching him.
Exactly. Yeah. And even like then, he's got the presence and the awareness of mind to know, hey, wait a minute.
If the simulation, had been something along the lines of Sinclair being debriefed by his superiors after the Battle of the Line, because he went off the grid for 24 hours.
Yep.
I'm sure
it's a huge problem.
He went through some sort of extensive interrogation, to find out what the heck happened to you out there.
Had to be, right?
Force.
Right.
Put him back in that situation. Put him in there. Have this other pilot who died. There was clearly an emotional connection there. Have some of these people showing up and asking some of the questions, to really throw him off balance. Take him out of his own environment. The fact that the simulation keeps him on the station, which is his home ground.
Mm-hmm.
I'm only an amateur. Torturer and psychological agent here. PsyOps is always interesting to me, but it seems like they were just going about everything absolutely the wrong way.
Right.
They have, and there are moments where you think, where you can see that the homage to the prisoner. He wakes up and he's in the new, he's in the simulation, just like at the prisoner, beginning of every episode, it shows
correct.
Him, waking up in this room, and now he's in a different location and he doesn't know anybody or anything.
Right,
he's constantly asked. Sinclair's asking, "What do you want?" The same sort of thing from the opening.
Right,
but whoever these guys are, whoever these Night One and Night Two are, as I said in the episode, they're clearly well funded. They're working for somebody. There's something going on behind all of this, just like there was behind the Home Guard back when when we saw them attacking on the ship. I wish they'd sort of thought it. Through a little bit more.
It's like their writing and directing instincts, if they had been more informed by a careful viewing of those last two episodes, or if they had been kind of more thoughtful to the ways in which mind control, let's say the way a mind control cult works or something like that, which, of course, this is 1994 that this is being done. If I were directing this episode, I'd want to have read about Jonestown.
Yeah.
I mean, let's say I don't know anything about The Prisoner. I don't know how that's possible if you're working for J. Michael Straczynski and you're making this episode. He's got to be talking about it, it would seem to me. Right. Mm-hmm. So let's say you don't know anything about that. You still know about Jonestown. So, why not try something like that? I think our instincts are always to be wanting this show to be more subtle than it is. Mm. And the people in charge of it are always going for a little bit more,
directness. They're charging full steam ahead. And honestly, if we look at the landscape in 1994, I don't think that, I think we're saying this from 23 years later, where television has gotten more subtle.
Right.
And where I think we come to expect these kinds of things. And if we look at other Star Trek, here we go talking about Star Trek again. One of these days we'll have an episode where we don't mention the other show.
Right.
But you look at the other shows that were going on at the same time, I would bet that we see a lot of this lack of what we'd see today as a lack of subtlety. But at the time, it was just perfectly normal.
Yeah. You know, you think about, okay, you're going to talk Trek. The episode where Picard has been replaced and he's being tortured by that card by David Warner.
Yes.
The immortal David Warner. Mm-hmm. And, there are four lights, right?
Right.
Even that alone. And I'm almost certain that episode predates this one, right? Even that alone was more subtle than this, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, look, it's the episode itself is a rather heartfelt homage, I think, to what The Prisoner was great at.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm glad that we got the episode, right? And I'm glad that we got it as it was, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because much like Babylon 5, The Prisoner in its day was a series that was prepared to take on really difficult, really unpleasant stuff that was going on in society, right? You know, there was that the episode of The Prisoner that CBS wouldn't even show because it was viewed as being too anti-Vietnam War.
Right.
Right. And, I think when you are assessing the cultural legacy of something like a television program or a film or whatever, it's how prepared are you as the filmmaker, the showrunner, whatever, to really do some of the ugly work of what your society is throwing at you.
Mm-hmm.
And, double kudos to Babylon 5 for getting in there and doing the work, right?
Right.
Even if it doesn't get it exactly right, and look, we're talking on a Babylon 5 podcast. We're setting a very high bar. We expect this program to get over the very high bar that we, in our conversation, we want it to be as perfect as it can be, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a pretty great episode.
Yeah.
Right? We get a lot of stuff that I've been saying in past episodes of our program, I wish we would get. And we're gonna get to that in a few minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And much like The Prisoner, this show is prepared to take a stab at some of these hard questions, and it does it over and over again.
Yep.
And that is to its credit. If you look at a line of culturally responsive television, well, Babylon 5 is in the same family as The Prisoner because it's making a real go at it.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's my take on it.
Yeah, there are plenty of shows back in 94 and today that will shy away from stepping up to those lines. I think it Babylon 5 may have had the benefit of being on a smaller, more independent network, not having the giant network machine of ABC or CBS,
right,
that would be intervening and telling them, no, you can't do this, no, you can't do that.
Right.
I'm trying to think, and I do wish that I were a better scholar of early 90s television. Trying to think of other shows that would tackle these kinds of issues. Star Trek stepped up to that line and stepped back fairly consistently.
Yep.
In the Next Generation and maybe even Deep Space Nine, stepping back from that much more than the original series did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that Star Trek from the 1960s was far more like Babylon 5 and like The Prisoner than, at least in my argument, the way I would argue it is that Star Trek The Next Generation had ample opportunity to make pretty bold cultural statements about the future. And unlike its parent program, it didn't take them.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that will always be on the negative side of the ledger to Star Trek The Next Generation, a program which I think is great. You know, I mean, we why do we reference it all the time on this program? our program. Why? Because, one, it's going on at exactly the same time. Mm-hmm. And two, if you're going to look at the legacy of sci-fi television, you're going to talk about Star Trek all the time.
Yeah.
Right? Because there are 750 episodes of Star Trek mm-hmm. in one incarnation or another. Right? And so, you know, it's the 500-pound gorilla right. of the genre. And so if it doesn't do something, it sort of redounds to the rest.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't think that it would have addressed as much of the, you know, the growing tension among on the home front. It certainly didn't address that. You know, in you get the sense, with only few exceptions in the Star Treks of this era, that you know, the Federation is one big happy family, and that everything, right. all you know, social problems on Earth have been solved, and everything is great and
right.
and wonderful and fine. And that's definitely right. not the picture that we get here. This, you know, aside from the Knights themselves, we still don't know what's behind them, but we
right.
we're getting a, more of a picture of Earth than what's happening there.
Right, and it's kind of alarming, right? Yeah. It's quite bleak, you know. The this line of dialogue from, I think it's from Night 2, you know, look at Earth, alien civilization, alien migration, aliens buying up real estate by the square mile. What they couldn't take by force, they corrupted inch by inch. Mm. Huh. Okay. We have to remind ourselves, you know, the Earth-Mimbari War was 10 years ago, right? That war was caused by a botched first contact,
mm-hmm.
right? Humans and Mimbari have almost no time to have gotten to know each other. 10 years is nothing.
How long did the year run? Did the war run? I'm sorry, I can't remember if you know
that I don't know.
Yeah,
yeah. We'll have to look it up, or a listener will be kind enough to point us to the yeah. error of our ways. Yeah, I don't think that I don't have any sense of that.
Mm.
I'm sure it exists. I just don't
yeah.
know.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So maybe call it something like what? 13, 15?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, 15 years ago in our own timeline, it's 2002. It's 9/11.
Yeah.
Right. Of course, that's continuing to have a legacy and an impact on, you know, on our culture today in the United States. Right.
Right.
I mean, imagine what a war that you all but lost.
Mm-hmm.
The war was over. Earth was about to be occupied.
Yeah.
Okay. And then suddenly it's not. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, over the last decade, for reasons that nobody can discern, Mimbari and other aliens are showing up all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What is going on this planet? You can imagine people who don't subscribe to those values, who are not universalists,
mm-hmm.
would be saying, what is going on?
Yeah.
Right? And it doesn't take all that long to generate, you know, pages worth of ridiculous conspiracy theories.
Sure.
Which, if you're well-resourced, you're then going to try to unpack.
Right, right. And a lot of, if you've got that ability to dig into it, you can. They come back to Sinclair, as we see here. He's
yes.
He's pivotal because it's at that moment when he's gone. So what did he do?
Right. Right.
But to the average person, without those kinds of resources, maybe the details of the War of the Line are at least his role is not known too publicly.
Right. You know, I mean, why would it be? Right.
Right. You would assume that there was some sort of larger act going on. Was it the EarthGov completely, you know, selling out to? Mm-hmm. Was there a secret surrender? Was there some sort of deal reached it would be unfathomable. It would be like, you know, if the Allies in 1945 just all of a sudden like, oh, we're closing in on Berlin, and oh, we're just gonna pack it up.
Right.
How could you even? Yeah, it's not surprising that there's all of this questioning that in some cases turns into hostility turns into violence and right. conspiracy.
Right. Yeah, and really turns into, and you know, it's a you know, it's not the left turn at Albuquerque; it's the left turn at Crazy Town.
Yeah.
Right. We're so obsessed with Sinclair, and we're so convinced that he is the linchpin. Absent any actual evidence, so we've got this kind of Captain Garth, machine to tear apart someone's mind. And why?
Yeah.
There are telepaths everywhere. Use a
right.
There must be telepaths. I mean, look, we already know this from the newspaper.
We do that
the Psi-Corps is getting involved in things that it probably shouldn't be getting involved in, right?
Right.
Right.
So I guess the implication there would be that the people who are behind this effort also don't trust the telepaths.
Right.
I'm not sure how that's going to play out down the road, but that's, you know, that's an implication. That's the only logical implication of why they would use this technological method. You know, again, questioning the methodology of did they really think all of this through very well?
Exactly. But that newspaper,
yeah,
the behavior of the Knights, their obsession about these questions, the fact that they're still raw in Earth society, right? The apparent conflict between President Santiago and Vice President Clark on this question. You know, Santiago being a bit more on the our culture is improved by having aliens amongst us, whereas Clark is really much more a xenophobe might be too strong, but he's let's dial back immigration a little bit, right? It's an intriguing almost everything that's said in this story arc, in this A story, does what I've been asking this program to do for the last six episodes of our program. Give us more depth about what's going on Earth.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost drinking from the fire hose this episode.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Even in that newspaper alone, there's all these great hints. There's, you know, we see an article about the Psi-Corps being entangled in the election and endorsing the vice president.
Right.
You know, there's an article about the Home Guard, you know, an attack on the Mimbari embassy. There's get that there. We get all kinds of things, you know, and is there something living in hyperspace? Oh, that could be interesting. Knows. But yeah, that's, you know, and again, I'll echo what I said last time we saw Garibaldi reading a newspaper. Why the heck are there newspapers?
WTF,
you know,
right?
limitations of 1994, someone writing at that time, I understand. That's you know, thinking that things are always going to be that way, I guess. But yeah, we're seeing a lot, and that it's very messy on Earth.
Right, right. And that messiness, you know, really expresses itself here. You know, in you know, on the station, you know, we see a lot of that too.
Yeah.
As the humans, you know, try to grapple with the ongoing legacy of this war, and the sort of choices and decisions that it imposed on people, right? I'm mindful of the exchange between Dr. Franklin and Ambassador Delenn, right, where apparently Earth Force was preparing to do weapons development of a kind of weapons of mass destruction that are kind of morally abhorrent.
Yeah, certainly these things would be banned by today's Geneva Conventions.
They're
looking at biological weapons. And that's, you know,
right.
Yeah,
right.
And this was a great scene. This, you know, it was a short scene, and I think it gave us, you know, it gave us more about Dr. Franklin than we got, you know, from all of Infection, which was really supposed to be his spotlight episode.
Yeah. Ostensibly about him, right? And what we got was not a lot of, to me at least, meaningful development. Whereas you know, this very short conversation where he, you know, he plants himself firmly in a moral stance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a moral stance that puts him in opposition to his own people and to his own leadership. And he takes, you know, what amounts to, at least in my judgment, you know, a bold and principled position. Mm-hmm. And that is to his great credit.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like he sacrificed, you know, well, he destroyed his notes and then he went, maybe I have the order of operations wrong here, but and then he just went ship hopping. You know, he sort of went on the lam.
Right. I mean, he when presented with an opportunity to support his people by giving them his research notes, which would have allowed perhaps for the development of, you know, biogenic weapons. That's a, you know, heck no, I won't go.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's the, you know, that's the Earth Mimbari War equivalent of crossing the border. You know, yeah. You're not going to draft me into your, yeah. into your moral insanity.
Yeah. Although I wonder how much he really had in his notes, you know, since he comments just a minute before that about he's never really had an opportunity to examine Mimbari up close.
Right.
You know, so.
Right.
Well, given that.
What could he possibly know?
Yeah. How extensive were your notes? You know, did it just say they have tiny little ears that are a little too low? And, you know, he's taking a big stance over what's really not a lot of stuff.
Right. Right.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'll take your point, but I'll counter it simply by saying look, he even if the notes that he had were full of junk,
mm-hmm.
he was given an instruction,
mm-hmm.
and rather than obey it, he made the moral decision that obeying that was wrong. And he didn't do it. Now, okay. I'm putting it in that way, yeah. folks, because we're going to come back to this in next week's episode when we talk about Deathwalker.
Mm-hmm.
The episode Deathwalker and the character Deathwalker.
Yeah, yeah. We're not going to say that many good things about good Dr. Franklin. So not that many nice things. So let's not miss this opportunity to do
right.
so.
Yeah. Right. You know, we Yeah, we threw him under any number of buses when we talked about infection, and this is a real opportunity. This was a real shining moment for him. So let's give him the credit he deserves.
Yes.
Yeah. So Chris, we're coming towards the end here, and yes. I'm wondering if you have identified a line of Straczynskiistness for I have. I'm wondering you if
know,
you have.
I didn't really have a strong one. A lot of the things that Knight 2 was saying, you know,
yeah. Knight 2 sort of, inclusive, right?
Yeah, it's basically all of these together. Yeah. You know, for the last time, what happened at the Battle of the Line? You know, that kind of thing. I think I'm just gonna lump all of those together. I'll play my one get out of jail free card this week and not come up with a specific example.
Right. Okay, so here's mine.
Yes, please.
Okay. Maybe you're asleep. Maybe you're insane. Maybe you're dead. Maybe you're in hell. I am, if you won't stop talking. Not that it matters much, Commander Sinclair, because wherever you are, wherever you go, you're mine. Bwa-ha-ha-ha-ha.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah. I have to imagine that was about the sixth take, and each time it was, can we get it a little broader?
You know? Oh, that's right.
Can you bring it up a couple more notches?
Yeah. Your eyes aren't bulging out quite enough.
Yeah.
Can we work on that? Can you? Yeah.
Before we go, though, have to step into my IMDb corner.
Yes, go.
Knight 1.
Oh, yeah, I know where you're going.
Yeah, you know where I'm going with this.
Judson Scott. Right.
From the 1970s, the five-episode-long show, The Phoenix. You know, he was
that's not where I thought you were going.
What? I don't know what
you're
talking
about. What are you talking about now?
What? He had this amulet. It was awesome. I recall watching that show when it was on, and it was and thinking that it was really super awesome. And it's probably utterly terrible. But now, of course, you know, you're going to point out his uncredited role.
Apparently,
in The Wrath of Khan,
Judson Scott, Joachim, the main henchman to
his son. Wasn't that Khan's son?
Oh, I don't know.
Thought he was. And that's why he was so broken up when he died. But according to Wikipedia, Judson Scott's agent, pushed a little too hard to get him higher billing.
Oh.
And it ended up with him getting no billing at all in the film. So.
Wow.
But, yeah. Yeah, Judson Scott and that magnificent hair.
He does have one of the best heads of hair in all of science fiction television.
Yeah.
Yeah. So can you imagine him as a Centauri?
Oh, that would go for days.
Magnificent. Mm. Right? Mm. Yeah. The more wild your hair gets, the higher in your status.
And the more virile.
The higher status you are. Right. So they should have made him, you know, God Emperor of Centauri. That's correct.
Yeah.
His hair would have been like a royal wedding train.
Exactly.
He would have needed 12 concubines to carry it behind him.
Yes.
See, Chris, this is further proof that I simply don't understand why people don't give us a lot of money to make television programs.
Exactly. We would.
I mean, that's a genius idea.
Yeah, it would be great. You know. But we'll keep plugging along here at the Name of the Pod until we get some of that great Squarespace or Blue Apron money or whoever's funding podcasts this week. So please, if any corporate sponsors are out there, we're not above selling out completely and utterly.
We're not above that at all, in fact.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone who's not a corporate sponsor, please let us know what you think on our Facebook site, either by emailing us at thenameofthepod@gmail.com. Go on to iTunes or other podcast homes and give us ratings and reviews. Help us get into that new and noteworthy so that other people can hear these wonderful insights about that we're spewing about.
About Babylon 5 and about television.
Yes, those things. We actually say something that makes sense about those things.
Correct. The most important takeaway from this episode, if you haven't watched The Prisoner,
yes,
get out there and watch it.
Yeah.
All right, folks. Be seeing you.
Be seeing you.
Ha ha!